We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 5th of October, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we are broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio here in the centre of Sheffield. We're going out on FM radio and through our internet live stream. And whichever way you're listening, the show is also available as a podcast later on from the Sheffield Live website. Talking podcasts, last Friday's show featured Sarah Silver. She is a German to English translator. She specialises in translating for the chemical industry. And she gave us also some brilliant tips. If you want to do business with Germany, then she knows what you need to know. So if you missed it, then the podcast is, of course, up on the Sheffield Live website. That was then. This is now. Who is on the radio show today? Well, it's great to be welcoming back James and Paul from Food Circle Supermarket. They were last on back in March. We'll bring them on in just a moment. But before we do, what's been going on in business and social enterprise? What's been going on with you? Well, the shortlist for the Sheffield Business Awards was announced this week by the Sheffield Chamber of Commerce, and a whole range of exciting businesses are up for accolades, ready for the awards ceremony coming up later on in the year. But congratulations to everyone who's been shortlisted. Fantastic news. Also, Sheffield is in the news itself. It's one of the best cities in the world to start a digital firm. We're behind only Quebec and Winnipeg in a worldwide list compiled by an international software firm called Celix. And they ranked cities based on 22 factors relating to infrastructure, support, cost of living, cost of launching a business, and a number of other factors too. Leeds was on the list as well. They came sixth. And the news was came just 24 hours after a Silicon Valley firm called Bossa Nova announced that they are going to base their UK HQ here in Sheffield. Last Friday on the programme, we talked about new research from Social Enterprise UK into the value of social enterprises in the UK. 100,000 social enterprises contributing $60 billion to the UK economy, employing hundreds of thousands. If you haven't yet had the opportunity to look at that research, do. It might change your perceptions of social enterprises. It talks about the size of social enterprise as being enormous in comparison with other sectors too. So without further ado, I think it's time to welcome our first guests on the show. Coming up later on, I should have said, actually, we have cartoonist Rob Middleton. He's based in Japan and makes his living as an illustrator. So that's a fascinating interview. But before we turn to Rob, I'm really pleased to welcome James and Paul from Food Circle Supermarket back to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Jamie. Thanks for having us back.
Thanks very much for coming back. It was, I think, March last time you were on, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah. Feels like yesterday, anyways.
Indeed. And, well, there are many reasons for coming back on air, not least because your business is fascinating and I want to hear about how you've been doing since you were last on. But you had some brilliant news this week, didn't you?
We did indeed, yeah. You've just mentioned the Sheffield Chamber, the Sheffield Business Awards. We've been shortlisted for the Universities Award by Hallam, which is great. But also this week, we had the privilege and the honour of winning the Hallam Enterprise Award earlier this week. So it's been a good and busy week for us.
So absolutely fantastic. And I'm going to ask you what that award means to you in just a moment. But for anyone who hasn't come across Food Circle Supermarket, can you just sort of introduce the business in a sort of 2-minute intro? What do you do and who do you work with? What do you sell and so on?
Yeah, of course. So we're an online retailer of healthy food and drink at a discount, prices up to 50% off the high streets. But the reason we can do that is that we purchase surplus food and drink directly from the manufacturers or brand owners. Well-known brands that you'd see on the high street, such as Naked, Trek, Grenade Nutrition, which is like a high-protein brand, Fulfill Nutrition. So we purchase their surplus food that would otherwise be going to waste. We purchase from them, are able to sell at a discount to people that want to live healthy for less and, you know, enjoy a fitness lifestyle at a lower cost.
Grand. Excellent. So you are a channel between those manufacturers and consumers. Everybody wins. Everyone benefits. Mm-hmm. And you've been recognised for your achievements in terms of getting the business set up, getting the business growing, presumably your sales figures. What were the judges looking at when they made this award, do you think?
I think they were looking at a mixture of sort of our progress so far and future potential as well. So I think, you know, it reflects really well on my ex-university, Hallam, to have students coming through that are starting businesses in the local area,
yeah,
and contributing to the local economy and have the future potential to create jobs as well. But I think, yes, for our entrepreneurial journey, I think it's just it's a recognition of that, really, and as well as the potential of the business, like we said.
Yeah, grand. So in terms of how the business has progressed since you were last on air in March, as we said, what have been the highs, what have been the lows, what have been the challenges, what have been the things you're most proud of in the last 6 months or so?
I think it's probably worth mentioning when we did the pitch, just on the question just asked James, we actually wore matching blue waistcoats to look like Gareth Southgate. So I think that's
that wasn't the tactic, that wasn't deliberate, but that was the byproduct of wearing the waistcoat.
Yeah, that went down really well with the judges. But anyway, so since we were on in March, we've come on leaps and bounds, obviously with challenges along the way, which is really finding out what our customers want from us, what sort of brands they want, what sort of service is expected from us? Because we're an online e-commerce business, so obviously a delivery business. You know, when do people want their products? How do they want it? What are the main brands that people want? At what sort of discount? And also find out ways for people to find out about us. So find a marketing formula that works really well, and so people can understand our business quite easily, and then, you know, want to purchase from us as well.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the highs and lows as well, I think when you're in any sort of B2C customer service facing kind of business, that comes with its challenges. You know, you can't please everybody all the time. You know, mistakes sometimes get made, you know, genuine mistakes. So you have to sort of deal with those challenges. But you do sort of you get used to those challenges and start to, you know, enjoy serving your customers as best you can and solving their problems, really. And I suppose the other challenge has been, like any startup business, is, you know, getting the thing going and getting it up to scale so that you can actually, you know, get to a point where you're making a living or almost making a living from it. So
I think for anybody starting an e-commerce business, especially if you're not using Amazon or eBay straight away, being able to get people to find out about you and raising that awareness, it's tough, but there's a lot of ways to do it, and you've just got to try a lot of things and keep, you know, testing and learning, really.
Yes.
Which is something that we believe in passionately, and we always are really helpful advisors and mentors. It's something that they try, an attitude they drum into us as well.
The attitude in terms of testing and measuring and learning and refining.
Tracking what we're doing, refining things, and also having patience, because not everything works first time, or some things don't work at all. So you have to learn from that and really be patient and find a formula that works. And it's probably taken us, you know, it took us probably the first 4 or 5 months of our business to start to find that formula.
Yes.
And now we have found it. We've started to, you know, experience growth, which is great.
Yeah, grand. Okay, so what sort of growth are we talking about in percentage terms? How are you growing? How fast? And so on. I mean, you might not be able to announce turnover on air, but is the business 2, 3, 5, 10, 20 times larger than it was in March?
compared to March, we're probably talking 10 times larger, at least.
That's pretty dramatic.
We've had a pretty good growth spurt over the summer as well. So we kind of took quite a big jump in revenue over the summer months. And then we've continued steady sort of month-on-month growth since then. So I think when you start to gather that sort of momentum, you know, you see things starting to happen and it starts to take off, and that gives you a lot of encouragement that what you're doing, you know, is going to work and is working. But obviously, you know, on the flip side of it, not being complacent and keeping on learning and tracking things and adapting as well.
Yeah, it just comes from trying things, like we said. You know, if you keep doing the same thing that's not working, then obviously it doesn't make sense.
No,
so you need to just keep trying things. And once you find what works, then obviously you've got a formula then to pour
more resources into that.
Exactly.
Absolutely, yeah.
So for you then, has it been things like sponsored posts or boosted posts on Facebook or pay-per-click advertising, pay-per-click advertising, or other digital or offline? What's worked well for you?
Facebook advertising has been has been really helpful. But alongside that, doing partnerships with companies that share similar customers to us, such as the Gym Group.
Yeah.
So we've got a partnership with the Gym Group. There's a branch in Sheffield and Calum Island who I've got a close relationship with, whereby we advertise in their gym and do pop-up shop events there to get talking to members and introduce our service to them. Because people go to the gym regularly. It's not our only customer. Not everybody that buys from us is goes to the gym regularly, but some of them do. So that's a way to interact with them. And that's been a fantastic way for us to...
Yeah, and it's a win-win for the gym as well, because their members are getting value from what we're doing as well. If we weren't adding value for them, obviously they'd want to charge us, or they'd want to not want us to have that partnership. So working with people like that, advertising advertising in the right places and targeting the right sorts of customers as well. So we've done some advertising with Celiac UK, because quite a lot of our products are gluten-free.
Yes.
So we've done some advertising with them, which is the biggest gluten-free celiac charity in the country. And also, like Paul says, social media advertising, really getting a handle on what works, who we should be targeting, what sort of budgets we need to put behind that, and what the return on investment is.
Yes.
Finding all that stuff out has really helped us on our growth path. And that's been the main driver, really, in the last few months of growth,
Grand, super. And you're sort of talking about the absolute importance of measurement here, testing, and then ploughing your efforts into what does work. Have you had support then from your mentors in terms of what to measure? Because there are a whole load of things that you could measure, but some of them are perhaps vanity metrics, and some of them are crucial when it comes to return on investment. So are you getting support, continuing to get support? Have you had a lot of help with that? Have you figured it out yourself? Has it been sort of a mixture?
We've had an enormous amount of support. We're talking about it last time we were on the show, actually. But in terms of vanity metrics, it's a really good point. Things like how many likes you've got on Instagram isn't the most important metric, really. Finding out your conversion rates and all this sort of thing, and cost per customer acquisition on marketing campaigns. And in terms of the people that have helped us, Business Sheffield are amazing. Hallam University, our advisors there, Rob King being one of them, really help us to refine our marketing, figure out what are the important metrics. So yeah, absolutely, we've had a lot of help.
Yeah, and I think our website back end, we've got a new and improved website now as well, which has happened since we were last on the show.
Yes.
And that tells us all these metrics, but sometimes you need somebody else's input and somebody else's angle on it to sort of make sense of it. So you can look at it and say, we've had this much traffic this month, this much conversion, and it can fluctuate from week to week. And getting those advisors on board to say, why that might be, and try and help us to identify it. And sometimes it takes that sort of person that's a little bit removed to get to the bottom of it. So, like Paul said, we've had a lot of support from the university, Sheffield Hallam University, from the advisors there, from Rido as well, Rotherham Investment and Development Office.
Brilliant.
And several other people as well.
Grand, super. And when it comes to the business that you're in terms of buying stock from manufacturers, and your consumers' demand, do you ever get a situation where what your consumers want, you can't necessarily get hold of because there isn't the surplus stock there? That's and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the supply. It's all supply driven, basically.
Yeah.
So we're offered whatever the manufacturer has, and we have to find the customers that
you
want
find
it,
the
basically.
Customers for it, yeah.
But some of our, a lot of our customers do come to us and say, "Oh, you're getting this flavour of something that you've got already," and it's like, "Well, we will if we're offered it, but it's not something that we can necessarily proactively go out and get." But we do take that on board. But yeah, it's about educating our customers really about what it is, because if they think this is just a shop where it's at a discount and they don't know the reasoning behind it, that might sort of peeve them, if you like, as to, it's not got the range that I want, it's not got this flavour that I like. But the fact that we tell them about surplus food, we educate them about the fact that what they're doing and what we're doing is stopping food from potentially going to waste, and which is good for our environment as well. That sort of gives us that leeway and that acceptance that actually, if we've not got that flavour, then we might have your second favourite flavour or something. So... Yeah, our customers are on board with our with our ethos mostly. So that's the great thing about it. We get to tell our story to both of our both our customers and our suppliers or clients or whatever you might call them.
Grand, yeah, absolutely. Now, part of the prize at the Hallam Enterprise Award, it's not just the recognition, the glory, the adulation of your peers. It is, there is a prize, a fund as well. And I think it's a £5,000 prize from Santander.
Correct,
And then runners-up each received a prize as well. So the Happiness Bootcamp, run by Amy Browse, and Howard So, who runs Fuller Flavour, the chilli sauce company, they won prizes too.
Yep.
But you get a £5,000 prize, so that's great. What's that going to enable the business to do that you wouldn't have otherwise done?
Do check out, by the way, Fuller Flavour and Happiness Bootcamp. They're amazing businesses.
Yep.
So it's great to do the event with them. But in terms of the prize money for us, it's going to be huge because we can work with more brands, more manufacturers, more amazing stock that our customers love and want. Because like James said, you know, we've got a close relationship with our customers where it's a two-way conversation where we ask them, you know, what do you want us to feature? And there's probably customers listening to this now based on our growth that purchase from us. And we encourage that, you know, getting in touch with us saying what sort of brands you want us to work with. And also, of course, marketing spend.
Yeah.
So it's the sourcing the supply and then marrying that up with raising more awareness about us. And that'll go a long way to doing that.
Yeah. So it's about expanding our range and expanding our customer base.
Fantastic.
Quite simple. Yeah.
Well, it's brilliant. And it must have been a good night. And I know there was also a pitch award as well on the night. And that was run by Torrell Ewan. So the crowds judged his pitch to be the best pitch on the night. Now, you must have seen that.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
So he's got a breakdance competition judging system, a piece of software. And he did a breakdance himself at the end as well. So obviously everybody was up on their feet, loving that, clapping, everything. So, but his pitch was fantastic as well.
We'll have to do that at the Sheffield Business Awards, won't we?
Yeah, might have to work on that a little bit.
Sounds good. Well, James, Paul, it's been really great to get you back here in on the show and talk about Food Circle Supermarket. So I'm going to ask you to sort of close off the interview by giving the website address so that people can take a look at the website.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be on. Thank you, Jamie. The website is foodcirclesupermarket.co.uk, and you can find us on social media as well. On most of it, we're Food Circle Supermarket, but on Twitter, we are Food Circle UK.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to come in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Congratulations once again.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing again from you in maybe 6 months' time and further stratospheric growth. But very well done.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
And this is Business Live, our weekly business and social enterprise programme on Sheffield Live with me, Jamie Veitch. Now, if you're running an exciting business or social enterprise and you want to be on the show, put yourself forward or comment on something that we discuss, or local, regional or national policy when it comes to supporting businesses and social enterprises and how it affects you, then get in touch. Drop me a text, 07904 272 200. Find me on Twitter, Jamie Veitch, Sheffield Live on Twitter as well, or send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of meeting up with Rob Middleton. And Rob was on a jaunt over to the UK. He is based in Japan. Rob works as an illustrator, and he describes himself as someone who worked briefly as a financial advisor, wasn't very good at it, and so took a different career path. So I was intrigued about what it's like to work in Japan. So I caught up with Rob for an interview, and well, we're going to hear from Rob Middleton right now.
We're open for business live.
Okay, so hello, Rob. Thank you so much for joining me on the radio today.
Oh, thank you, Jamie.
So can you introduce yourself in your own words? Who are you? What do you do?
Sure. So I'm Rob Middleton. I'm originally from Lowestoft in the east of England.
Yeah.
And now I'm a cartoonist and illustrator and teacher based in Tokyo, Japan. But there's been a bit of a journey to get there. In my previous life, I was a financial advisor in Norwich.
Yeah.
I did that for quite a short period of time. I retrained to teach English as a foreign language, and that took me over to Budapest, Hungary.
Yeah.
Then after that, I went over to Japan for just 1 year and then stayed for another year and then another year, and the years tended to blur into each other.
How many years is that now?
It's coming up to 20 years, I think. I'm starting to lose count somewhat.
Grand. So what an interesting journey from financial advisor through to teacher and cartoonist and illustrator. Absolutely fascinating journey, geographically as well as your business journey.
Yes, I should have also added, at uni I majored in design and visual studies, so you can see the progression from design to finance to teaching English. So
absolutely.
Kind of a bit of a zigzag.
Grand. Now I want to ask you all about Japan, working in Japan, and we'll come on to that in a few minutes. But you're an illustrator, you're a cartoonist, and I know that cartooning is something that has been a lifelong interest for you. It's something that you then turned from a hobby into part of how you earn your income and do business. So this is absolutely fascinating to me in terms of making that decision and making that jump from investing in continuing professional development as a teacher through to choosing to jump into cartooning and can you make a living from it? So tell us the story behind that.
Okay, well, I'll start off with the cartooning side of things. So when I was very, very young, huge influence was my grandfather. He was an engineer by profession, but he was quite a talented amateur watercolour artist. And so he encouraged me to do art by giving me, you know, bits and bobs, pieces of paper that he didn't need, pencils, etc. And I used to do some watercolours myself, but it was always drawing cartoons that I gravitated to. So whether it's copying things from the Dandy or the Beano or Garfield or whatever, and then eventually developing my own little comics just for myself.
Right, yeah.
And so that started from a very early age.
Yes.
And I've continued it as a hobby. And then later when I went into teaching, it became very useful in the classroom. Well, either in the classroom on the blackboard or the whiteboard or preparing materials for lessons.
Yes, so the cartoons, you were using those as teaching aids to illustrate
That's
your
right,
lessons,
yeah.
to support points,
That's
and
right.
to engage pupils as well.
Sure, and a long time ago, probably about 10 years or so ago, before I started doing mainly high school work, which I do now, I had a stint for 2 or 3 years teaching in elementary schools in Japan. And at that time, English in elementary schools was very, very new in Japan. And the area I was working in was, they didn't really know what to do with it. They were kind of disorganized, and I came into the school and they basically said, here's a spare classroom, we have no books, we have no materials, can you help? I said, okay, who's the art teacher? And I found the art teacher and basically borrowed all the materials, or got all the materials from her, and basically built everything from scratch.
Right.
So there's all flashcards and posters and things like that. We made some kind of little books that I could tell stories with.
Yes.
So that was quite an intensive year.
Yeah, it must have been.
Looking back now, to be honest, I haven't really reflected on it until now, but that year was probably quite pivotal in terms of me suddenly kind of being forced by circumstances to draw a lot more than I would have been. Up until that point, it would have been just for fun, just as a hobby.
Right, but you had in effect a clean slate there.
Yes.
And the opportunity to create a whole bank of resources.
That's right, yeah.
And you seized that opportunity, obviously. You use that chance to develop your skills, presumably, as well, and get resources out there and, in many ways, test those resources, test the material that you were creating. And I suppose it must be incredibly satisfying to see in immediate terms the reaction to a cartoon, if it's a teaching resource, if you're using it in a classroom. There's
sure.
no sort of remoteness to it.
No.
The people for whom the cartoon is aimed are sitting right in front of you, and they, if they love it, they probably show that love of your work, your cartoon, they probably demonstrate that they love it or that they hate it.
Well, that's very true. With small children, you get immediate feedback.
Yes.
I mean, one example was I used to draw cats in a very different style. So one day I was drawing different animals on the board and asking them, you know, how do you say the name in English? And I drew what I thought was a perfectly good cat. And I go, what's this? And the silence. I go, you know what this is? It's easy. It's a cat. And they're like, no, it's not. I'm like, yes, it is. And there's about 30 little voices in unison saying, no, it's more like a dog.
Really?
And so I drew a few different cats until I found one that was acceptable. And my cats have never been quite the same ever since. So.
Never quite the same since.
No.
That's amazing. So what we're going to do, I'd like to fast forward now
sure.
to talk about the work that you do, the style of the work of the cartoons and the illustrations that you create now.
Sure.
And then we'll jump back again in time to sort of further explore how this has come to be.
Okay.
But I think it'd be fascinating for us at this point to go into what the work is. So
sure.
cartooning, illustrating, that could mean a wide variety of things. So tell me about what you create these days and the type of people who buy your work.
Okay, well, at the moment, I'm primarily engaged with illustrations for book projects.
Yep.
And they tend to be heavily animal-orientated, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
So some examples of current projects, there's a lady in Northern Ireland, Carol, who's a dog trainer. She's been training dogs for several decades. I think she's already got one book, and now she's doing another book on dog training, which I'm illustrating. There's another lady in America who a few years ago found my old website and wanted to do a little children's book. She'd never done anything like that before. She wanted just to do it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I illustrated that one for her. And then about a year after that, there was another one that followed. And then at the moment, we're about to start work on a third one.
Right, great. So it must be satisfying to see your work in a book.
Yes, yeah. No, it's great to... I mean, it's fun to see it in any form, but when there's a physical copy and you can hold it up and show it to people and look at the pictures, there's something about it.
Grand, super. And it seems that it's very popular these days for people to commission cartoons as gifts or caricatures as gifts or images as gifts, as presents and so on. Is that something that... is that a market that you've worked within? Have people asked you for personalised images as presents?
Sure. It's a market I've stumbled into.
Mm.
It's not one I've sort of actively sought, but people have found my site and asked me to do a picture for a friend or husband or wife. So I've done a few of those, and as a result of that, I've been working a lot more on my caricature skills, which were never really my strong point, but have definitely got a lot better since working for other people.
Right. Okay, that's really interesting. And my son has told me all about the phenomenon of cartoonists on Instagram pitching for work and offering to draw a cat or nine cats or however many cats for different amounts of money.
Right.
It's amazing, isn't it, how social media has become a channel for some people to gain work. And I wanted to ask you about that, because
sure.
you mentioned a couple of minutes ago about people stumbling across your website.
Mm-hmm.
So what's been your approach to getting your name out there and your work in front of people and securing the type of work that you most want to do, whether that's, say, a book illustration project?
Sure.
What has been your approach in the past? How has your approach to marketing changed or developed or evolved? What's worked best for you? What have you tried and hasn't worked so well?
Sure.
I think that would be really fascinating to hear about.
Well, in terms of my approach to marketing, until fairly recently, I didn't really have any approach. I had a website which I put up, and I added quite a number of pages to, but basically I didn't do anything to promote. And I'd made a few half-hearted attempts to market myself, but basically, it was people stumbling across my website by accident and then contacting me.
Yeah.
During the same time, I also did a number of cartoon ebooks, which I put on Amazon. And similar to the website, it was relying on pure chance that people would find a book and buy it. And so since then, well, it's a bit of a light bulb moment, to be honest. I thought, well, if I'm making some money through people finding me by accident, if I actually learned how marketing worked, I would get more customers and more money.
Yes.
I know that sounds a mind-numbingly obvious thing, but it was... Sometimes the idea is so simple that you miss it.
That's so true, yeah.
And I think also that was kind of indicative of my mindset at the time. I was fairly comfortable with the drawing side of things, but it just showed that I was basically more somewhat clueless about the marketing and business side. So that's what I've been working on since.
Okay, grand. So first of all, it's a step change in kind of philosophy.
For sure.
The understanding that rather than having people stumble upon you, and also, and this is the case for lots of small business owners and particularly perhaps freelancers and creatives and so on, taking on projects because someone's come to you and you're self-employed or you're running your own small business or whatever, and so it's kind of, yeah, I'll have to do that because it's what someone wants, rather than necessarily taking on the exact type of work that you want to do the most. So you described really elegantly, I think, there, that step change in philosophy and that light bulb moment in terms of the understanding that you can be proactive.
Sure.
And if people were actually stumbling across you and buying your services, if you were actively marketing, you would find more. That's great in terms of the philosophical change.
Sure.
What did you do about it? What have you done? How have you gone about getting your name out there and securing the type of work that you want to?
Right. Well, even after I had that insight, it still wasn't exactly a very smooth process. I did a few courses.
Yeah.
And I think I had the idea that, okay, if I just do one more course, then I'll learn more skills, then finally things will start to click. But the point I'd missed was it didn't really matter what course I did. And all of the courses I did were fine in their own right. But I actually had to work the process. I had to put in the time. I actually had to complete the courses and do what the designers of the course, the instructors were saying. I think if any one of those courses, if I'd chosen and worked to the maximum, would have got me results. But I didn't work the courses.
It's a common thing, though, isn't it, in business? People go on a course but then don't actually implement what they've learned.
For sure.
Read a book or have a business coach or mentor, but, you know, then expect it to happen magically. But if you don't do...
And it's a common trap, whether it's for business or fitness. It's like, well, I join the gym equates to getting fitter. I sign up for a business course, I become better at business. Mm. Well, no, you have to, you know, put in the work.
Yeah. Okay, so you did a number of courses.
Sure.
You then realised that actually that wasn't going to be a magic bullet to make things automatically happen. What happened next?
Well, I realised that if, for whatever reason, I wasn't able to get myself to market things more, I thought, well, I have to find someone who can basically help me out with it.
Yes.
Until I learn to do it by myself. And I sort of also realised at that time, I think it was more to do with inner blocks, sort of the psychology stopping me rather than it being rocket science and something that's unattainable. So I thought, okay, well, until I learn how to do it myself, I'll find someone who can help me out, and then that'll speed up the process.
Right. Okay. Great. So then you're accountable, I suppose, and you have support, you have access to expertise.
Sure.
Yeah. Good. So how is it going then in terms of development? What advice would you give to a cartoonist in a different style or a elsewhere, not necessarily in Japan, whether here in the UK, whether they're a listener in Sheffield. Sure. But of course, we have listeners all over the world to this program. But what advice would you give to someone in terms of how to market themselves now, based on what you have learned so far and what you've been doing so far?
Okay, well, I think one of the first things would be, regardless of what someone feels their ability is at the moment, say in terms of their cartooning, it's not what their ability is, it's whether someone wants to buy their work or not. So there's some really good cartoonists out there who are absolutely terrible at marketing. Mm. And there's some people who are maybe, say technically their drawing skills aren't so good, but they're a lot better at marketing. And more importantly, people like their work and want to buy it.
Yes.
So I think that's a hurdle for anyone to get over. And certainly that's something that I had to get over. And eventually, as I got more commission work coming in, that helped me to growing confidence that people like my stuff. Now I'm over that hurdle and now have to market it more effectively and then see the confidence grow.
Yeah, so it's an understanding that a wonderful talent, a mm-hmm. talent that you've nurtured, needs to be communicated and sure. shown to people, and you need that active engagement in sure. communication and marketing. Okay.
And the other thing is that's been huge for me is simply having the accountability.
Yes.
Because my main living as a teacher, I'm accountable for everything. I see my peers every day. I see my students every day. It's never a problem hitting any deadline, getting any work done whatsoever, simply because I have to. And that's the nature of the job. However, I found that trying to work for myself, building up the side business, I wasn't holding myself to the same degree of accountability at all.
Right.
I thought, okay, now I've got to figure out a way around that.
Now, that's interesting. Was it a case of you had optimistic ideas regarding timelines, getting things done, planning ahead, thinking you would do things, but then there was slippage, you weren't holding yourself to account and so on?
For sure, yeah. Yes, because I'd often start things and they would carry along for a while and then I'd let it slip, and then, you know, 6 months later I was thinking, well, what happened to that project that I started?
Yes.
So I thought, okay, I need something more consistent, I need a system to follow, or more importantly, someone to kind of keep me in check.
And accountability.
Sure.
Yeah, grand. Okay, now I want to come back to that again in mm-hmm. a moment, but I thought it would be an absolutely wonderful opportunity to introduce somebody else to the conversation here, Gerald the Goat. Tell us about Gerald.
Okay, Gerald the Goat. Well, Gerald the Goat happened by accident. I was playing around with a character called, I think he was called Stan at the time. It was a very simple, minimalistic, 3 or 4 panel strip, usually with no words. And Stan was going to give a bunch of flowers to his girlfriend, and the bunch of flowers was hidden behind his back. And while he was talking to his girlfriend, Gerald the Goat appeared and ate the bunch of flowers.
Right.
So Gerald was basically a prop to this one cartoon.
Yeah.
Then I drew him again a couple of other times, and I got a few comments, and then, so I draw Gerald more, and then it's slowly developed to the point where he is by far the most popular character I've ever drawn.
Mm-hmm.
So I draw a Gerald the Goat strip, which appears on Facebook, and then appears on my site, and also my newsletter from time to time.
Yeah.
And since starting off drawing with Gerald, I've learned a lot from drawing it, because I've drawn this character more than any other character, so you kind of get to know the character as you draw it, and also taught me a lot in terms of how to develop strips. Now, in the early days of Gerald, he was basically eating things and butting people.
Yeah.
That was it. And then I thought, okay, well, if this is going to have legs, I have to develop different ideas. And so I started to develop different characters as well. And then it even got to the point where sometimes he wouldn't even appear in the strip himself. It would be the other characters. So that's taught me a lot in terms of how to keep the strip going and the interplay between the characters.
Okay, lovely. So Gerald has come into his own, and his character development. There's yes. an arc here.
Yes, yes.
great stuff. And you mentioned that he has generated perhaps by far the best feedback of and again thanks to the joys of social media, there's a very rapid response mechanism for you to gain feedback when you put characters out there. You mentioned Facebook, so Facebook is something that you use to gain a following, to showcase work. Is that the most effective social media for you? Do you use others? How does it compare to, you mentioned a newsletter, emails, what works for you, Rob?
Still experimenting with social media, to be honest. So at the moment I'm using Facebook and Instagram. I put videos on YouTube. There's a drawing software I use called Procreate, which I'd recommend to anyone who's interested in cartoons and illustration. There's a great feature in the software where it records every single brushstroke when you're drawing something. So when you're finished, you can do a time delay replay. So you see it going from blank canvas to completed cartoon.
I bet people love that.
It's fun to see the process. I mean, I think people like to see the process of anything, whether it's drawing a picture or someone, you know, making a dish or repairing cars. There's all sorts of things. So those I upload onto YouTube.
Grand.
And then as well as those, I have a newsletter that I put out Monday to Friday. Pinterest I've sort of dabbled with. It's a bit on the back burner at the moment, simply because sort of juggling all the different social media. But Pinterest for sure I want to return to, because that's basically an image search engine, so that's something I should be taking more seriously.
Great. Again, that's really interesting in terms of how that's evolved, the different channels that you're using, and how they help you to reach people. Again, I'm going to pivot, if we can, briefly to another question, because we have lots of folk listening to this show, business owners, who may well have considered writing their own book or writing resources, for example, to help their clients. And you've mentioned working with a couple of people to illustrate books. So I know from talking with and working with illustrators, graphic designers a lot in the past myself, a common frustration is getting a brief that isn't very specific, very tight, but is really vague, woolly from a client. And then doing what you think the client wants, giving it to them, and the client going, "Nope, don't like that." And I don't know whether that's A, something that you've had to face, and if you have any tips for how to deal with that, that would apply to other creatives in terms of how to get your clients to give you tight, specific briefs. B, there's a second question there, which is, do you have any tips for clients if you're commissioning a creative, an illustrator? How do you go about giving them a really good, solid brief? So, double whammy question there, Rob.
Okay, well, what I try and do, first of all, if at all possible, is to talk with the person via Skype. Because when it's face-to-face and it's going on now, you get instant feedback to the questions as well, and you see the body language, and you immediately see in their faces, and they'll see my faces, whether, you know, I'm understanding what they want and they're understanding where I'm coming from. So yes, I would immediately have a call on Skype if at all possible. And then we'll basically try and ask as many questions about what exactly it is they're looking for, and try and find out as much information up front. I kind of learned this the hard way, because in the past I didn't find out so much information, and then sometimes they'll get back to me and say, well, this isn't quite right, can you change this, or that's not actually what I was looking for at all. So basically, the more information I find out up front, then the smoother the process is. And I think also for anyone freelancing, it's not necessarily the, say, in my case, it's not necessarily the skills of the cartoonist or the designer they're buying into. I think it's they're buying into your skills as a communicator. because they want someone you can communicate with.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same if I buy a product for myself. I'll sometimes go out of my way to a shop or say buy something that's a bit more expensive because I have more of a connection with the person or with the company, or
yes.
I feel the service is better. And I know I could probably find it cheaper elsewhere, but I don't want the potential hassle that might come from that dealing with someone I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. That really does make sense. Okay. And so that then applies to a client if you are engaging a designer. It's
sure.
A cartoonist, an illustrator. Get that communication, that face-to-face or Skype communication, and explain what you want, what you want it to do for mm-hmm. you and why, I suppose, as well, the big why
yes.
behind
yeah.
it. Why are you actually commissioning this illustration, and what's it meant to do in terms of bring your whatever it is, bring your thingamy to life?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Okay, great. It must be fascinating living in Japan, and mm-hmm. you teach English as a foreign language
I
there
do, yes,
as well.
Yeah.
And I know from talking before we started recording that you have created some cartoons in Japan for a colleague and with a colleague, a mm-hmm. drama teacher as well. I know your clients, the people commissioning you for your cartooning work, are here in the UK, in America, all over, mm-hmm. as you've described. But what's Japan like as a place to live? I can't really say as a place to do business, because you're doing business internationally.
Yeah, it tends to be international.
Yeah, but observations in terms of, you know, I haven't had the pleasure of visiting Japan myself. I've visited many places all over the world, mm-hmm. but the idea of visiting Japan is fascinating. Tell me more about what it's like to live and work in Japan.
Right, well, for me now, after almost 20 years, it's just everyday life, so it's actually quite rare that something sort of catches me out now.
Right.
When I first got there were, you know, many things that sort of threw me for a loop. I mean, one of the early ones was I spotted a beer vending machine.
Yes.
And I was beer vending machine in full working order.
Right.
And then a cigarette vending machine also in full working order.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, these haven't been vandalised. And there's not all the high school students rolling around drunk and smoking. I thought, okay, something's going on here. Something's a bit different. So I live in Tokyo now, and I've moved around a bit, but over half my time's now been in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And how would I describe Tokyo? It's kind of like a love-hate relationship with Tokyo. There's so many things I like about it. There's the energy, there's so many things to do. There's the hustle and bustle of being in a big city. Then on the flip side, with any big city, you've just got so many people and the noise, and it's difficult to switch off. So I'm still happy being in Tokyo, and I do wonder now whether I'm slowly turning into a city person, because when I was in the UK, I worked in Norwich for about 3 years, and then I never even thought about the idea of living in London at all. I thought, okay, I'd like to visit there, but London would be far too big. And then about a year or so later, I ended up moving to Budapest in Hungary, which was bigger than Norwich, but not as big as London. And got used to Budapest, so okay, this is doable. And then after that, when I was about to move to Japan for the first time, I was my contract was with a chain of private language schools. And on the application form, there was a box where you could fill in where you wanted to live and work in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I specified Hokkaido. Now, Hokkaido is the northernmost big island in Japan.
Yes.
Now, I ended up in Kanagawa, which was about an hour and a half south of Tokyo.
Right.
And I later found out when I got to Japan, basically nobody got the place that they listed on the form.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I was south of Tokyo for a year, maybe 2 years, and then I ended up going to Tokyo to fill in for a teacher who I think had quit, something like that. So I was there just for a few months, and then kept coming back to Tokyo on some other contracts, and then eventually I ended up living there. and yes. I've just got used to the pace of the city.
Yes.
Good and bad. So.
Pace, good and bad, yes. And the size and so on, yeah.
But it's really, really fascinating because it's... I'm not sure how big Tokyo is in terms of city rankings, but it's up there in terms of big, big cities.
Yeah, indeed.
But the big thing which basically everyone comments on is things work. So it's a huge, crazy city, but things work, and that's always impressive for me.
Right, OK. Now, that's impressive indeed if infrastructure is slick, smooth, gets people where they need to be, mm-hmm. and so on. Grand. So we could go on. There's so much I would love to ask you more about, Rob, and I think we'll have to get you on the radio programme again. I want to give folk the opportunity to check out your work themselves, whether it's one of your cartoon books available on Kindle or from Amazon, whether it's taking a look at your website. You mentioned social media, signing up to your emails and so on. But I'm going to give this open to you now in terms of how you'd like folk to check out your work, how you'd like folk to make contact with you and investigate, see what you do, and even, of course, to how folk can meet Gerald the Goat.
Okay, thank you, Jamie. So I can be found at everyonelovescartoons.com. And my email address is rob@everyonelovescartoons.com. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram. Gerald the Goat appears all over the place, so sometimes on Facebook, on Instagram, on the website. I also have a newsletter, cartoon newsletter, I put out Monday to Friday, and Gerald also appears there. And if you want to sign up for that, you can do so via the website.
Grand.
Okay. And as we mentioned earlier, I draw a lot of animals, cats and dogs, so if anyone's got a cat or a dog they want drawing, then I'll be happy to have a chat with you.
Excellent. Well, that's been really fascinating, Rob. I really appreciate you taking the time whilst on a visit from Japan here back to the UK to talk with me and to talk with us on the radio today. So Rob Middleton, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to tweet out those links as well from my Twitter account, Jamie Veach, and Sheffield Live will tweet the links out as well. Now, you do not have to be a Twitter user. You can simply look me up on Twitter, type in Jamie Veach into the Twitter search box. You'll find me, and from there, you'll be able to find the links to Rob. So if you're listening now whilst you're doing something, don't panic. But if you've got a pen and paper or your computer to hand and you can type in the addresses, I'm going to give Rob the chance to give his website address out one more time for us before you go. Rob, what's the address again?
Sure, it's at everyonelovescartoons.com.
Super. That's been fascinating. It's been great speaking with you, Rob. Rob Middleton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate your time.
This is Sheffield.
You're listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veach. And on the show today, we've been talking with James and Paul from Food Circle Supermarket. They won the Hallam Enterprise Award this week, and they were talking about their business, how it's grown. It's grown dramatically since they were last on the show. And their award win, what they'll be able to do now they've won the money in the Hallam Enterprise Award. They also gave some tips on e-commerce. So if you've only just tuned in and you've missed the interview earlier on today with James and Paul, then don't panic. The podcast will, of course, be up on the Sheffield Live website later on today. We've also just heard from Rob Middleton. He's a cartoonist based in Japan and an illustrator. And I was talking with him a couple of weeks ago, and I caught up with him when he was on a visit over to the UK, and he talked about growing a cartooning business and illustrating business. Really interesting speaking with Rob. So again, podcast, you'll be able to find it on the Sheffield Live website if you've missed that. So what are you up to in business and social enterprise? What's going on with you? Do you want to be on the show? Well, you could be. If you get in touch, tell me what you're up to, tell me what you're doing, react to something going on, policy, how it'll affect you, and so on. Always welcome to contact me. We've got a whole host of interesting and exciting interviewees lined up over the coming weeks, but we always love to hear from you and perhaps put yourself forward to be on the show. Get in touch. That's about it for this week's programme. But next up on Sheffield Live is our fantastic folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk, on from 10 all the way through to noon. And Sam Hindley is, of course, presenter of Thank Goodness It's Folk regularly. And it's his birthday today, so happy birthday to Sam. So stay tuned for Thank Goodness It's Folk from 10 all the way through to noon, and come back next Friday to hear an interview with entrepreneur, business leader of an engineering firm, Chloe Watmore. She's joining me on air next Friday to talk about taking on a family business and growing it. So tune in then. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to James and Paul from Food Circle Supermarket for coming into the studio earlier. Thanks also to Rob Middleton for the interview recorded a couple of weeks ago, which we played for the first time today. Thank you, Sangeeta, in the studio as our sound engineer. We'll be back next Friday, 9 a.m. through to 10. Tune in then, but right now, enjoy Thank Goodness It's Folk from 10 all the way through to midday.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.